And welcome to the July 16th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would please all rise and join me with a flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, changes to Jay's agenda, please.
Amendment number one to the July 16th board agenda. Addendum to item number nine, fiscal year 2013-2014, special education local planning area contract renewal. Staff is amending the recommendation, correcting the dollar amount to read $773,212.00. Amended items to close session. One, conference with labor negotiator. It is the intention of the board, sitting as the governing board of the San Luis Obispo County in-home support services.
Not only amendment to the lease, but also a memorandum of lease. The recommendation line is accurate, however. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I have no other requests to speak from the public, and seeing no one else coming forward, Ms. Owen?
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. I was requesting more information and possibly a report on a visit to Washington, D.C., as well as Sacramento with the California Energy Commission workshop. And in Washington, D.C., it was with the American Geophysical Union Science Policy Conference. And this was appears to be discussing the seismic study issue at Diablo and getting input from NRC, I assume. I just would like you to report on it because it's very important to a lot of us that are still following the seismic offshore testing. And I hope that Mr. Gibson could give a report on his trip and the findings. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Owen. With that, we'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board for items to pull. Starting on my right, Mr. Meacham.
No, sir.
Ms. Arnold, Mr. Hill.
None, thank you.
I will be happy to comment on item number two. During our break, I did take the opportunity to travel back to Washington, D.C. I was grabbed my attention was the American Geophysical Union, which I am a member of by virtue of my first career as an exploration seismologist, had a very interesting workshop, seminar, public meeting regarding science and public policy. A lot of it had to do with the science of climate change and how that informs public policy, and a lot of that had to do with hazard mitigation. And we are seeing quite clearly that the that scientific studies in ballpark terms indicate that we're going to see a 1 foot sea level rise by 2050 and a 3 foot sea level rise by the turn of the next century, and that poses a number of important issues before local jurisdictions, state jurisdictions, and the federal government. And so it was a chance for a lot of very highly skilled and focused scientists to present information that I think is going to be very important to the future decisions that we're going to have to make. It was attended by a wide range of policymakers, including folks from the California Coastal Commission, or at least one individual from there, and other staff from state and federal offices. While I was there, I also did take the opportunity to drop by and visit Congresswoman Capps and just informed her on a number of issues that are continuing along within the county, not least of which is the Cayucas Pier and our search for some funds to stabilize that. And I also had an opportunity to meet with the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and update her on the activities of the independent peer review panel and what technical work we are doing as regards the seismic hazard at Diablo Canyon. So all in all, as a vacation went, it was quite interesting and I hope productive in the long term. So with that, I would entertain a motion.
I'll move approval of consent with
amendments.
As amended?
As amended.
Got a second? Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Mr. Hill and Mr. Meacham, approval of the consent as amended. Madam Clerk, a roll call.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you very much. That moves us then to our public comment period for items not on the agenda. Just for future reference, I would like the public to know that I would like to have all requests to speak in public comment on the dais before we open that item. That is as a means of organizing our time. So as we move along here again, if you do have interest in speaking in public comment, I will ask that the slips be on the dais before we open it. Opening it then, we'll start with Eric Greening, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I'm glad Lindy Owen is still concerned about seismic testing issues in our waters. Here's another one. The State Lands Commission has just issued a mitigated negative declaration that is out for comment now on what's called the Offshore Low Energy Geophysical Survey Permit System Update. It's quite long for a negative declaration, and then there's a bunch of appendices. It gets pretty technical. One request I have, because the format doesn't download well into all computers, there is the opportunity to agendize this before your board. And in some way, first of all, I will point out that we're not talking miniature decibels here. The output of the different boats that would be used is anywhere from 198 to 230. Granted, that's within a meter of the actual sound source, but it can't always be counted on to attenuate, especially when it's in focused beam. And they tend for this type of survey to be focused downward, meaning monitors aren't necessarily going to see what's being affected. This isn't particularly Diablo-related. The purposes given, the need for the project, didn't mention that, although it did say it is not limited to. But it's of interest that 30% is oil and gas related, although not necessarily surveys for gas deposits. Some of it is pipeline type stuff. It's also of interest that while the territory covered is from the Mexican border to the Oregon border, from 08 to 12, 55.6% of the activity was in Region 2, which is from the Santa Barbara Channel to the Monterey County line, in other words, around here. So this should be of great concern to all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Dr. Height, followed by Ben DeFada.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos World Community Workshop. And I've invited everyone to get to the Steinberg Gallery on Monterey. There's an exhibit of protest posters, and this is the last week and weekend that it will be up. And I've brought you some of my own creations. How do you tell a child they have no hope? How do you tell a mother they have no hope? New Orleans Mother's Day Parade. If it had a gun, we'd all be dead. Require background checks. Responsible gun owner until he shoots someone. Require background checks. Responsible gun owner until he shoots somebody. End gun violence. And I have a new creation that won't be in the show. Next time you rob me, use a gun like everybody else. Equity for the prohibition zone. Once I get started on a theme, it's kind of hard to stop. But I want to remind everyone, the community is concerned about what is happening in their community. And the prohibition zone and the people of Los Osos are literally under the gun. Next time you want to rob me, use a gun like everybody else. Next time you want to rob me of the quiet rural community in which I and many people chose to live and turn it into your own vision of the future, use a gun like everybody else. Next time you want to rob me of my ability to get to the coast, to coastal access, to get to a bus stop, to have bus stops to coastal access, to get anywhere. Next time you want to rob the people who have to go to dialysis and their drivers are being told, oh, no, you can't get through here. And they are only lucky that their drivers will persist and advocate for them. Use a gun like everybody else. Next time you want to rob us of our health, of our fresh air, of our quiet community, use a gun like everybody else. Los Osos, you know, next time you want to rob us of our dignity, next time you want to profile us and try to make the rest of the community believe that we are what you believe us to be, rob us of our reputation, of our good works, use a gun like everybody else. Because you can rob people in many ways, and I'm not just talking about what the property owners are being burdened with. There are, now that buses are being rerouted and I can see the entire community, there are many, many apartments. And the problems with landowners hiking the rent in anticipation is already happening. We are going to be displaced. Thank you.
Mr. DeFatta, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good morning, Board, Sheriff, and Public. I am Ben DeFatta from Los Osos, where many will lose their homes because of the cost of you choosing a gravity sewer project for Los Osos instead of the cheaper, better, faster alternatives. What is really needed here in Los Osos is an outside investigation on why you picked this $200 million gravity sewer project when we could have built one for $50 to $100 million less. Just like the present liberal progressive politicians in Washington, D.C., who oversee themselves where no one is fired or goes to jail for screwing the public. San Luis Obispo County seems to have the same disease by investigating themselves for wrongdoings. Cacho says it's a job security. As to the Los Osos, alongside the much smaller pipes of low pressure or vacuum pipes, you could put in the purple pipes that would go to every property owner to use for landscaping. Last week I mentioned that the slow green build was going to submit to you that Los Osos must save another 50% of their water usage by saving rainwater and abandoned septic tanks to use for landscaping. Good idea if it ever rains, but purple pipes is better. Board members, it's so easy. You put your ego in your pocket and do the right thing for those poor property owners that reside in the prohibition zone of Los Osos. If you really want to save our basin, use purple pipes alongside wastewater pipes that go to every house in the same trench, saving us a lot of water and money. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta. Thank you, Mr. DeFatta. Ms. Owen, followed by Julie Tapper.
Lindy Owen from Los Osos again. I think that is the key phrase here. It's never too late to do the right thing. And I will, I find it a little objectionable that we are being asked to get speaker slips in, which is what everybody tries to do. But we have people that arrive on buses, and your schedule for public comment changes daily, I mean weekly. Last week it wasn't until almost 11 o'clock when we had public comment. So I hope that that is not an item where you cut somebody off in the future, because you're going to have to change the way you set up your agenda. And what I really wanted to speak to is the issues as it's never too late to do the wrong, to do the right thing. Also involves Los Osos. When we get into, right now the project is busy with the easy parts. When I say easy, they're not easy, but it's a lot easier than when you have to try to dig an 18-inch gravity trench in high groundwater. That scares the living daylight out of me and anybody that is concerned about our water basin, because the discussion is 9 million gallons removal daily. And both crews, construction crews, will be doing their own separate. So we're talking up to 18 million gallons of disposal that is needed. That water is not garbage. It's not waste. It's far better water than what we would get from Nacimiento, and far cheaper than what we could get from desal. And it needs to go back into our aquifer The proposal at this point is to put it over on the Tri-W, which can't even hold a million gallons a day. It can't hold even a million. So I want to know, and I want you to do the right thing, to look at the hybrid technology for the high groundwater areas. It was written out in your proposal that if it came to that, that's what you would do. That means directionally boring and using a vacuum system. The better system was always the step collection system, but obviously you chose not to do that. And then, again, I'm asking for oversight. The Nacimiento project had oversight. County didn't just walk in and do what they wanted. They had oversight. And so did the Lopez Lake Dam project had oversight. This is a bigger project than either of those, and it affects way more lives at this point. And I need to have somebody up there agree that we need oversight. Just pretend like it's some other corporation building this sewer. It's your county, and it is having major problems, and nobody is able to do anything about it because there's no oversight. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Ms. Tacker, followed by Tom Dawson.
Good morning. I'm Julie Tacker from District 2 and Los Osos. I have a quick question for Supervisor Gibson. Your trip to meet with the NRC, is that at all reimbursable by the Public Utilities Commission and the PG&E money that was accessed when you were on the IRWP? I forgot the initials. A concern of mine today is what happened last week with Paso Robles and the apparent Brown Act violation. Nobody's been convicted of a Brown Act violation, but the Brown Act would have allowed the public to fully participate in the decisions and the direction that was given to your staff. What we might have been able to participate in is shaping that direction. And the public that wasn't here during that public comment or spoke to something else in public comment wasn't able to help you with good direction for your staff for the severe crisis in Paso Robles. What I came away from watching, the Jekyll and Hyde is in how the groundwater has been managed in Los Osos. In 2007, Supervisor Gibson was part of what voted the level severity 3 for Los Osos. We celebrated that because we thought we would have the protection. And today, we still do not have a groundwater management plan. And I want to see my supervisor stand up for Los Osos groundwater basin as he did Paso Robles.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Mr. Dawson, followed by Elsa Dawson.
Mr. Chairman and Board, good morning. My name's Tom Dawson. I wanted to speak this morning on Paso Robles groundwater. I was thinking about it. I have a well, and forming small water companies and sharing costs, allowing that group of people to dig deeper and have a longer-lasting well would also cause fewer wells in the area. Would be an idea for the folks there just as a solution. It save a lot of money per household. They could share costs. I encourage the county to streamline the process and lower fees to help out with that process. If anybody should want to do that, I've suggested it to several people in that area, friends, who are now sharing water with neighbors. This could be a short-term solution for many people there. As far as the scientific consensus about climate change, scientific facts are open to interpretation. Scientific consensus does not cause sea level rise. Over the last 50 years, there's been 1/4 of an inch in sea level rise. 33 years of that 50 years is the first third of the 100-year climate policy goal period that's been set by many people to get these changes done in 100 years. So it does not look likely that you're going to get 1 foot of rise in the next 37 years by 2050. Please don't waste our tax money by pursuing these things. Solar activity and ocean water turnover is the real cause of climate change. A lot of science on that. There are very few grants available with that interpretation, however. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson. Mrs. Dawson, followed by Dan Lloyd.
Good morning, Mrs. Elsa Dawson. I, too, left the meeting last week a little concerned, greatly concerned. It occurred to me that a substantive discussion of policy had occurred, and in addition, direction had been given and deadlines to staff to prepare an emergency policy or some sort of emergency ordinance. I also noticed that all four of you had expressed commitment to adopt emergency policies or at least measures. And when the Chief Deputy Counsel, County Counsel Tim Nolte, attempted to warn the board that their discussion had gone too far, that it had gone beyond just a discussion and had started to schedule, that he was sharply silenced by Supervisor Gibson. This seemed to me to be a flagrant ignoring of counsel's warning. One of the problems, of course, was that it hadn't been agendized. A second problem was that residents had not been notified. The county residents, the property owners, the agriculturalists, all of us who would have been impacted, greatly impacted, had not been given official notice and therefore had no opportunity to comment. This reminded me of the land use ordinance, and I had terrible feelings of all of a sudden having our rights usurped and never having been able to speak to it. Supervisor Arnold requested a method of notification to which Supervisor Gibson absolutely refused to send out postcards. This reminded me of the little article that was put in the Tribune that we landowners should have read and we should have known that you were voting on that. That's not notification. Again, when Supervisor Arnold asked about the Blue Ribbon Committee, the response was that it didn't matter. Well, my understanding is that the Blue Ribbon Committee was a collaborative committee whose opinion is very important. So again,
for this very important position, I also urge the board to use your HR department to cast as broad a net as possible to get as many qualified candidates in here for review going forward. I urge you to not be hasty in this decision. I think going forward, I don't think we need to immediately fill the position. What I'm more concerned about for our community and our county is that we do this right and that we get the best possible slate of candidates to evaluate. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd. Ms. McLaughlin, followed by Laura Mordaunt. And these three slips did come in after we started public comment, but we'll go ahead today as we are not in a big time crunch. Ms. McLaughlin.
Hi, thank you for having me. My comment to Mr. Hill, you don't know me, I'm sorry, from Adam, but you were very kind to me to allow me to attend a meeting that Mr. Teixeira and yourself gave a speech at the Chamber of Commerce for Rio Grande Grover Beach, sorry. So I wanted to thank you for that. I am in the area where Mr. Teixeira represented, and so of course we're without, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have heard Mr. Teixeira for, unfortunately we didn't know the last time. And it was really informative to hear your and his comments about important aspects of our area and what's going on. And my only question is, could we sometimes maybe do that where there's not a fee attached to it? Because I don't feel that's really in the democratic process to pay to understand where you guys stand on things. But in the meantime, I would like you to be aware that Oceano is still diligently trying to start a farmer's market. We don't have a local representative to help us with that process. Things are in flux, as you know, with the OCSD. Our general manager's in flux. One of the board members was just finally replaced. So we would like you to think of us when the time comes if we get this farmers market a little further down the process. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. Ms. Mordaunt, followed by my last request to speak, Bill Pelfrey.
Laura Mordaunt. I live in San Luis Obispo County. I wasn't able to be here last week, but in reviewing what occurred in the last session, I have quite a few concerns. Many of them have already been mentioned, and I get really concerned about emergency ordinances that then usurp many of the other ordinances or rules we have in place. That to me is, what are you doing? That is a taking, that's the shortest way I can say it. You do not do that kind of measure. If you have six people, I don't know how many have well issues, but let's really honestly look at the map configuration, the geology of the area. What part of the basin are they in? What are the configurations of that water table? And what are the usages and depths of others in the same area? What depths did they go to? And when, again, a citizen purchases a property, they have the responsibility to deal with whatever they purchased. If there are water issues, I don't believe all the rest of us should become the fixers and payers of that problem. I mean, that's the luck of the draw when you purchase. It's your due diligence. And if a problem comes up, why is it my problem? This is what I see repetitively as issues from the board, is that I have to pay, others have to pay for a few. I believe that we should care about those few, but we should put in mitigations and concerns for the few, not an emergency ordinance. What are you talking about? Why don't I just create an emergency and create such a situation that each of you will have to vacate your home? I mean, the ludicrousness of how this approach is so impactful, rather than dealing with situational problems. I do not understand why that is not done. And when it comes to informing the people, the ag cluster was an example. That little ad, you should be informing people about water. Water is the new gold, and that would be critically important. If you're not doing it, then that is a big mistake because you're not serving we the people.
Thank you, Ms. Mordaunt. Mr. Pelfrey.
Bill Pelfrey, Templeton. Last week I came to you with a problem that I was supposed to take to Mr. Serra, who passed away. Now I come to ask you, what have you done about it? There's a direct falsification of county documents. I showed you that we no longer follow the rules of law. I came here for redress, as I did to Mr. Serra. I didn't want to go to the courts. I don't want to go to the state's attorney generals. This is a direct violation of law. Instead, you went to an emergency ordinance thing to shut out the facts of what these people will be producing from the Blue Ribbon Committee and all the other committees, your modelers. What is the direction? First that day, you talk about how great a man Paul Tessera was, how even-minded and fair-handed. This emergency ordinance came before. It was voted down. Then, right after that memorial, you start ambushing what he stood for. And Mr. Hill says, we talked about this, and we told you it was coming down to this. The people did not know what was happening. You are here on the people's business, not your own. Your ideology should be checked at the door and listen to the people. That is your job. What is going on here? Do we no longer have a say? If we're late for public comment, whose time varies, am I to understand now that we're not allowed to speak? Where do the people stand? In your eyes, are we just victims to an ideology, to a conflict between the two? I came here with a grievance about a fact of manipulation of county documents and got shut down and moved to the back of the line. How many times this Board of Supervisors has one group of people got to speak one after the other and the rest shut down from view?
That was my last request to speak, so we will close public comment. And just going forward, again, I would like to organize public comment in the way that we have speaker slips in before public comment starts. That is actually in our board's rules of procedure on all items. And the reason for that is a simple matter of time management. We're more than happy to provide opportunity for folks to speak on items that are not on our agenda. And at the same time, we do have many other items and many other people's business to attend to. Our meetings are agendized for 9 o'clock. We try to get to the general public comment as quickly after 9 as we can. We do consent first so that we can let our very highly skilled and highly paid staff get back out to do their jobs elsewhere in the county organization. Today, and we'll ease this in. Today, again, I'm happy to accept late speaker slips, but we will be just working to make sure we understand how much time is going to be consumed in public comment so that others can plan their day around when we'll get to other items. I would like staff, if they would please, to just comment on a couple of things. One of them, there were a couple of suggestions that there were issues of the Brown Act in the discussion we had after public comment last week. I'd ask counsel to speak to that, and then maybe Mr. Buckshy could speak to the schedule going forward on the issues that that we discussed then.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council. Last week, as a result of a rather lengthy public comment, the board did make comments and direct staff to put an item on a future agenda. And I wanted to make it clear that the Brown Act does allow that. The Brown Act specifically allows a board to respond to comments made during public comment and ask questions of staff or commenters. They also allow board members to make brief comments or reports about what is spoken about a public comment. The Brown Act allows the board to provide staff references to certain documents that may come up during public comment. It also allows a request to have staff report back on items that come up, and it also allows the board to take action or direct staff to put an item on a future agenda. So I think we hit many of those issues last week, and in our view, there was no violation of the Brown Act. It was simply a response to a very lengthy public comment, and the item is coming back. No action was taken on the item that's coming back, but it did give direction to staff as to the breadth and depth of that item.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Neal. Mr. Buckshy, just a brief comment on schedule going forward.
Sure. You know, as was discussed last week, we've had a standing meeting scheduled for August 27th to discuss recommendations from staff and the actions that the board took at the early May meeting, and we'll be coming back with those at that point on August 27th. And prior to that, based upon the public comment from last week, we have scheduled a meeting for August 6th to discuss potential urgency ordinance options. Staff will bring forward options for how those could be structured, possibly bring examples from other areas, and maybe bring forward examples for consideration for this county. But it is not a noticed hearing in order to implement an urgency ordinance.
A facility to pay tribute and memorialize Paul Teixeira, and that's kind of been an ongoing thing at many of the meetings I've been attending. I have been out and about in the North County attending both Blue Ribbon committees and neighborhood meetings regarding the Paso Robles groundwater basin issue. As a board member of the Latino Outreach Council, we hosted, and actually Supervisor Teixeira was the key host, of a panel discussion. It was a panel discussion regarding the Affordable Health Care Act and how that will be implemented in the county. The HSOC committee, that the Homeless Services Oversight Council that I chair, has been proceeding with its goals of participating in the 100,000 Homes campaign with the end goal of being able to house many of the chronic and ill homeless folks in the county. And then beyond that, I'll take just a second to talk about the so many things for the benefit of the public out there, to let you know what all's going on and what we've been representing you, the people, what kind of events. So we have a new CAO for the YMCA here in the county. Monica Grant was welcomed at a reception at the Monday Club. I attended graduations up in Atascadero, both West Mall and Del Rio High. The Templeton Chamber of Commerce, after several years of not holding an annual chamber dinner, they held one recently, recognizing their Citizen of the Year and other dignitaries in Templeton. I was able to attend a dedication of Highway 101 interchange, memorializing CHP officer Brett Oswald, participated in the 4th of July parade in Templeton, and had the honor of having Erica Davis, a veteran who served in Iraq, join me and ride along with me in that parade. I have been attending, and it's an ongoing Tuesdays in the Park in Atascadero. From 5 to 7 each week, there's a barbecue put on by the Kiwanis, and the proceeds go to various nonprofit organizations. This evening will be Friends of the Atascadero Library and the Link, benefiting from the folks that attend. I had the honor of having Creston Elementary students visit me here at the Government Center, and they were able to visit the chambers and have a tour of the Government Center. And I want to publicly encourage any other teachers or school personnel that feel like they have the time and resources to bring their children here. I think most of us would be happy to host children of our district to be able to educate them on how county government works. I was able to attend the Elks each year in Atascadero, hold a police and fire appreciation dinner, and honor the public safety folks up in the district. I've toured Port San Luis since we last had these little updates. Mayor Tom O'Malley hosted a mayor's luncheon in Atascadero, where we were all able to visit the beautifully restored Rotunda building that'll be opening next month and become the new, or it's not new, it'll be restored as the city hall, and government business will go on there. But everyone should take time when it opens to go look. It's been so beautifully restored. The Quest of Volunteer reception that happens annually. The CSU Chancellor, Timothy White, visited the Cal Poly campus and gave us all an opportunity to meet him. I had the honor of presenting awards at the Special Olympics Spring Regional Games out at Cuesta. Attend the San Luis County Drug Court out at Mountain Brook Community Church, where that's been a successful program that helped citizens here in the county overcome substance abuse. Stand down the weekend where at the Veterans Center here in San Luis Obispo, a weekend of providing services to homeless veterans in the county. The Atascadero Library, after a few unforeseen delays to the construction, we're having a groundbreaking kickoff this week, Friday, 9 a.m., if anyone happens to be in Atascadero Friday morning. I was able to attend an Older American Month tea that recognizes volunteers that work with seniors, the grand opening of the apparel boutique at Pacific Beach Continuation High. That's the Children's Resource Center. Two Tippecop fundraising dinners. A lot of my colleagues here attended. Those funds also go to the Special Olympics. Mm-hmm. And the anniversary, this was kind of fun and something I didn't even know existed right out my backyard, but the anniversary of the rowing club at the Santa Margarita Lake, a rowing club that gives lessons and provides opportunities for folks that might want to take up the sport of rowing in the beautiful Santa Margarita Lake. So I'm gonna close now before I get hooked off the stage, but I hope that helps everyone understand how much we have going on in the county and the district. Thank you.
Indeed.
For the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. It still says 3 minutes. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Looking at the seismic hazard analysis at the Diablo Canyon power plant, we did hold a public meeting of the IPRP last week up in San Francisco. And again, these are technical meetings where we're considering various aspects of the geoscience that goes into establishing whether we know enough about the threat of earthquake to the safe operation of Diablo Canyon. Without getting too far into the weeds on it, I can just tell you that two of the major pieces of earth science that we've considered at the IPRP in recent months has been, one, how fast is the Hosgree Fault slipping? How fast do the two chunks of earth on either side of the Hosgree Fault move past one another? That speaks very importantly to the amount of energy that's present in the tectonic system there. And then the meeting on last Thursday had to do with how the characteristics of the site immediately surrounding the power plant, that is the rigidity of the rock and soil directly around the power plant, are to be determined, because understanding whether those rocks are soft or hard has a lot to say about how much the ground is going to move when an earthquake of a particular size occurs close enough to cause what we call strong ground motion. Looking forward, we will be looking at data sets that PG&E is working on right now. We expect in the fall to be having a fairly comprehensive review of the offshore work that they had done. And in speaking to Mr. Greening's issue with the State Lands Commission, I forgot to indicate I will look into that, and we'll ask our staff if we could be sure that we do have hard copies available someplace. Mr. Greening, just go ahead and use your normal contacts here, and we'll make sure we can get you the necessary information. Later on, early in 2014, we expect to see more information about the onshore the onshore studies that have been undertaken, and I forget what the overall analysis of the hazard will be looked at somewhere in the middle to late 2014. So there's still a lot going on there. I am sitting also as the county's representative, and we'll look forward to some more very interesting discussions. It's a good group of people who are digging in really deeply on understanding what we know and what we don't know about the seismic hazard at Diablo. So with that, I thank colleagues for their reports and ask Madam Clerk to introduce our next item, please.
Item number 25, consideration of a status report by Mike Miller of the Ferguson Group on federal lobbying activities being undertaken on behalf of the county.
Mr. Miller.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm Mike Miller with the Ferguson Group, and it's a pleasure always to be in San Luis Obispo County to give the board an update on things that are happening in Washington, D.C. Before I start, on behalf of myself and our firm, I wanted to offer the board our condolences on the passing of your colleague. I enjoyed meeting Mr. Tershier and always found him to be a very warm individual. I'm sure he'll be remembered here in the county for quite some time. Just moving forward, I wanted to hit three items, and I'm going to try and be rather brief this morning. First, I'd like to give you a brief overview of some relevant current events in Washington and how those might relate to some of the county's priorities. Also outline the past several months of work that our firm has done on behalf of the county in light of the current environment and circumstances in Washington, D.C. And then, as noted in our June 7th report, I wanted to outline a more refined approach for your consideration, refining the county's federal agenda to help us and the county promote the goals of the county at the federal level. Just starting off briefly with an outline of some of the recent movements in Washington, there's some sort of good news and bad news as far as how Congress is working together. This year, we are seeing more work being done successfully with respect to the annual appropriations process, and that in turn could allow the agencies to move forward more efficiently and effectively with grant programs that provide funding or could potentially provide funding for some of the county's priorities. The last couple of years, it's been evidence indicated that he will veto a farm bill if it doesn't have the nutrition title in it. The Senate bill includes this nutrition title, and now the question is whether a conference committee can form and develop a consensus and a compromise bill that can be sent to the president and be passed. The jury's out on that. We'll see what happens. If they are successful in coming together with some kind of a farm bill that the president can sign, then that might be an indication that this Congress is moving forward as far as legislation is concerned and getting things out and on time or close to on time. But it has been a problem over the last couple of years. Many folks point to the lack of congressional earmarks as the reason why Congress is at least one reason why Congress has not been working well together. And while there is some discussion about the merits of congressional earmarks and the merits of handing that authority down the avenues to the agencies, again, the jury's still out on what's going to happen there. We do not anticipate earmarks in the 2013 or the 2014 cycle that we're in right now. But we will keep you posted on how that moves forward. And for the board members who've been on the board for several years, you may recall that our agenda in the past had been driven to a great extent by the pursuit of congressional earmarks. And we enjoyed quite a bit of success up until the earmark moratorium was put in place. And it's been a difficult transition, not just for the Congress, but also for the counties and the other folks that we represent in transitioning from the congressional earmark approach to a more grants-based or administrative-based lobbying and federal legislative efforts. So but having said all of that, there is reason to have at least a little bit of optimism moving forward. We'll keep you posted on how this farm bill goes, and again, that might be a good indicator of what we might expect in the coming months and perhaps in the second session of this Congress. Moving into some of the things that we have been doing over the past 4 to 6 months, I think that Mr. Gibson briefed you folks on the April D.C. trip. We, I think, had some very good meetings with folks focused on transportation infrastructure. We met with a Fish and Wildlife official who actually has jurisdiction over HCPs, which is important to the county. We met with FEMA. We also met with the Bureau of Reclamation, which I'll come back to in just a minute because that's one of the places where we, I hope the county might be going as far as sharpening the federal agenda. We continue to provide our weekly Washington updates, our specific water practice updates, our grants updates, and other ongoing communications with the county to make sure that staff and hopefully you folks on the board are well informed as far as what is happening in D.C. One other thing I will mention is that we have once again this year in the first quarter done some work with SLOCOG and helped them with their DC work, and I think that that's been pretty successful as well. As the current transportation authorization bill comes up again for renewal, which it will very soon, we would anticipate doing some additional work with SLOCOG once again on issues there. You may recall that last time around there was a real risk that SLOCOG along with other smaller size cogs were going to be essentially cut out of the process and through SLOCOG's good work and other similarly situated cogs, those provisions were stricken from MAP 21, but it's something we need to keep our eye on moving forward. Taking this all into consideration and thinking about a good approach moving forward into the 2013-2014 cycle, about 3 years ago or 4 years ago when the earmark moratorium was first put in place, the board moved from a prioritized agenda where we identified two or three or four top priorities that were the focus of our work, and then we had additional projects or interests should opportunities arise. We moved from that kind of a prioritized agenda to a sort of a menu approach that I think matched well against what was happening in Washington. And by that I mean, you know, we needed to be pragmatic. We needed to be light on our feet so that if there were opportunities that came our way, we could match up, you know, from a menu of options. But now that the both Congress and the administration, you know, still uncertain but somewhat settled grant-making and budgeting process that Congress and the administration seem to have found their way into. But again, I will caution that there, you know, there is a lot of debate going on in Congress about how the budget process is currently working or not working, and there is likely to be some additional changes as we move into the next session of Congress and, in fact, the next Congress itself. So taking all of that, you know, my recommendation to the board is that we move back to more of a prioritized approach to the county's federal agenda and identify sort of two or three key issue areas, umbrellas, if you will, so that we can sharpen our message in D.C. That'll be helpful not only to the county in terms of, you know, knowing what you're going for and making good advocacy efforts on behalf of that agenda, but it will also help, I think, the congressional delegation in understanding what the county's top priorities are as well, so that we're not working off a, you know, a rather lengthy list, but they know, for example, when they're thinking about San Luis Obispo County, they're thinking, for example, about water resources. And in fact, that's, you know, the first item that I was going to recommend as sort of an umbrella agenda item, a water resources, water security, water safety agenda item that would focus then on, you know, achievable goals under that umbrella. We would be looking for infrastructure funding for specific projects that the county develops or already has developed to help with water shortages and water basin stability. We would look for technical assistance. That could become very crucial, actually, as you know, basins are at risk of contamination. You know, we'll be working with EPA and the Bureau of Reclamation, and technical assistance is likely to become, you know, very important with respect to water resources. And I, you know, one thing that I would like to mention is our firm, and we have extensive experience, especially in the Central Valley, as it relates to, you know, water resources. And we represent a number of water districts up and down the state of California. And we'd like to be able to sort of leverage that knowledge, not only, you know, within our water team, within the firm, but also our knowledge of the congressional delegation, you know, that represents some of the folks that some of the water districts and other water users, and then also the agency, you know, contacts and knowledge that we have in that regard to, you know, bring that to bear on this water basin issue that you folks are clearly facing. And I will say also on that point that there are programs in place under the Bureau of Reclamation, under USDA, that either, you know, right now in their current form or with some relatively minor legislative fixes could help potentially the county, not necessarily in the real short term, but as we look, you know, for a longer-term solution to water supply, not just in the North County but throughout San Luis Obispo County, you know, there are programs that could be very helpful in that regard. And, in fact, in April when we met with the Commissioner's Office of the Bureau of Reclamation, we talked about that as sort of a starting point, and I think that we, you know, have some we've established a good starting point with the Bureau of Reclamation in that regard. The second umbrella I'd recommend would be transportation and other public infrastructure. That captures not just transportation infrastructure, but also projects like Cayucas Pier and other types of projects that, you know, clearly they're very specific projects. They're public infrastructure that either needs improvement, maintenance funding, or even construction, for new projects. And then the perhaps third umbrella, and especially this one, I think, could use some additional sharpening, through your feedback and also discussions with staff, would be sort of a public safety and social services umbrella, where we would focus on issues such as homelessness, assistance to the homeless population, veterans assistance. In fact, right now there's actually a grant program that I believe is currently open related to providing transportation to veterans who need that assistance. I also see Yucca Mountain and Diablo Canyon under that umbrella. I've communicated with the county, I believe it was last week, that Yucca Mountain surfaced in the House Appropriations Bill, Energy and Water Appropriations Bill, funding that facility, and that's something that is continue to be of concern to San Luis. If I can't today, I'll get right back to you with answers. But I appreciate the time to be here and explain what we've been doing and a vision forward for us and for the county.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Questions from colleagues? Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, thanks yesterday for the meeting, and obviously you piqued my interest in a couple of areas in particular. And I guess what I'd like to meet further to discuss exactly, when you talk about your water team and what you can provide, I want to know what it is that you can provide. I want to know how you provide that. And then I'd like to know time frames in which certain things could happen so that we can be, I guess I'd like to drill down into more specifics about how we could approach some of this. I don't know how my colleagues feel about it, but I support the three umbrellas that you're talking about here because they do kind of branch out in a variety of ways that I think would accommodate a lot of the interests that we have. So that's it for me right now, and I look forward to further discussions with you.
Any other questions? We do have one request to speak, but if colleagues don't have questions at this point, we'll open it to the public. Mr. Greening?
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and thank you for being here. I'm going to raise a couple of other priorities. Number one, the Constitution. The revelations about the dimensions of the surveillance state are the kind of federal issue this county needs to take a position on. Rather than hounding a whistleblower around the globe, perhaps our rogue administration needs to be reined in by Congress, because every member of Congress took an oath to defend the Constitution, and the wholesale gathering of information about everyone in this country is unconstitutional and needs to be stopped. If Obama can't be persuaded to stop it, then Congress needs to make him stop it, and that needs to be front and center of our legislative platform. Relative to the encroachment of the surveillance state, given that it appears that the main feature of anything that passes under the nature of immigration reform will be creation of a drone surveillance zone within 100 miles of the border, which can likely be extended to non-bordered areas under any pretext, immigrant or not, I think we need to nip this whole thing in the bud, and I am on the side of gridlock and obstructionism relative to the passage of anything that passes as immigration reform this year. Also on the subject of drones, the whole idea of having federal domestic aerial surveillance law enforcement should be an affront to anyone who considers themselves a Constitution-abiding American. Also on the subject of drones, we need some clarity on the designation and the process of the six areas in which the FAA will permit drones to operate as a sort of pilot project. The boundaries of the one centered in San Diego have not been clarified to us as whether we would be in or out, but since it apparently would extend as far as the Naval Ordnance Test Station inland, there I would be very concerned. But we should have no part of it, and we should be very strongly lobbying against it. I would also suggest that the Ag Appropriations Bill that expires in September 30th, that we be vigilant to make sure that the so-called Monsanto Protection Act be detached from it and never be attached again, and in fact that we never allow a law to be passed that insulates itself or claims to insulate itself from judicial review, which is the whole substance of the Monsanto Protection Act, to essentially give the Secretary of Agriculture jurisdiction and even direction and immunize from judicial review. That's like a person standing on a mountaintop and saying, I'm above the law. We can't let a person or a law be above the law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening, for your comments, as always, touching on the big picture here. That will close public comment on this item and bring it back to the board for further thoughts. I did have one question, Mr. Miller, forgot to ask before Mr. Greening. In the Farm Bill, one of the provisions you mentioned was the nutrition title. And for those who don't know what that is, maybe you could give the brief discussion of what the implications of that are and what happens if that title doesn't get passed.
Well, it's thank you for the question. I appreciate that. And unfortunately, the answer is, you know, sort of it's unknown what would happen, but it could potentially be very bad for the participants in the food stamp or SNAP program. You know, we're talking about a program that, you know, literally millions of precisely the question that you ask, what happens if that program is not part of the farm
bill? So when the current Farm Bill expires, the food stamp program, also known as California Fresh or SNAP, also goes.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So very important thing. Thank you. Further thoughts, questions? Mr. Meacham?
Yeah, I just a question, I guess, for the board. At what point do we make the determination relative to the suggestion of the three umbrellas of which the legislative platform would be established?
Yeah, I think there's a couple options going forward. As we've discussed, I'll be bringing forward in the next couple weeks the contract for the Ferguson Group for your board's consideration, and depending upon the outcome of that discussion, I would plan to then bring forward our legislative platform for the upcoming year.
Thank you.
I support the concept. I think Mr. Miller is well up on these shifts in the way that Washington does business. That's not to say that they're doing it well, but I think it behooves us to understand it. And I think grouping our different policy and project initiatives under umbrellas and then sharpening the umbrella, if that metaphor makes any sense at all, I don't know that it does, is a good way to go. I think we've got a number of important things, and I think our connections there, we need to focus our connections on that.
And if I could, Mike, I'd like to chat with you further. To get the answers to my questions will have a strong influence on how we move forward.
Sure, absolutely, and I'm always available. You have my phone number and email, and I'll reach out to you.
Thank you.
I will also tell you that, you know, I think as I mentioned to you previously, you know, our water team, not just myself, but our entire water team is available to help put that particular agenda item together.
I want to know more about that. Thank
okay.
you.
Very good. Thank you. Mike, thank you very much for taking time to be with us this morning, and appreciate your insights on this. With that, it's receive and file. And so we have one more item for the morning, and I'm curious as to how long staff thinks their report might be, as the board is expected upstairs for a small gathering shortly. If we could do this in 15 or 20 minutes, I think we might have a deal here. So with that, seeing that guarantee issued by Mr. Wirth, Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our next item, please.
Item number 26. Submittal of a resolution adopting a policy governing bid protests and other challenges to construction bid contracts, all districts.
Thank you. Mr. Wurst, are you the man?
I think I did see it.
Button on the far left, yellow on.
I think I did see a James Bond episode where they sharpened an umbrella, so I think
it is possible. Staff, check that out.
Good morning. Jeff Wurst, Design Division Manager for Public Works Department. Item before you this morning is a request to adopt a policy regarding how the county will address bid protests for our construction projects. And in compliance with public contract code requirements, as a regular course of action and typically on consent agenda, your board approves projects, adopts plans and specifications, and authorizes advertisement for bids for construction contracts for both Public Works Department and General Services Agency. After bids are received, opened, and evaluated by staff, a subsequent item is brought to your board, typically on consent agenda again, recommending award of the construction contract to the lowest responsive responsible bidder. It is the objective of both General Services and Public Works that the bidding and award process be smooth, straightforward. However, given the size and complexity of many of our projects and the competitive nature of our current bidding climate, we have experienced an increased number of bid protests in recent years. Such protests may concern mistakes in completion of various bid forms, deficiencies in the pursuit or use of disadvantaged business enterprise participation, unbalanced bids, deficiencies in subcontractor listing or qualifications, etc. And as the number of bid protests has increased, it's also become apparent that governing body board meetings are not the best forum for discussion and consideration of the details concerning such protests. So the situation is further complicated in that General Services and Public Works have historically worked using different procedures for addressing bid protests. Consideration of this, the County Administrative Office has identified a need to have a uniform countywide policy that includes a procedure for addressing with final resolution of the bid protest at the department head level, and that the policy would be approved by your board. So in developing the policy, staff researched similar policies that have been adopted by other agencies in California. And it is worth noting that the counties of Placer and San Diego sought to have department head level authority for resolution of protests. Key elements of the policy before you today includes requirements for bid protest submittals, including identification of timing for such submittals, definition of interested parties, and requirements for the notification of the protest to the interested parties. The policy delegates authority to the department head of the department sponsoring the project advertisement, delegates the authority to make final determination on approval or denial of the protest. Policy also identifies the consequences of a protester's failure to follow the requirements contained in the policy. The policy defines communication channels of protester and county and other interested parties. And there are provisions for a protester to request, and the department head will have the discretion to allow, if appropriate, a forum to make oral presentations if the protester feels that their argument needs to be made in person. Department head will provide a written decision of his or her final determination concerning the protest. Policy provides for the scenario where a low bidder seeks relief from his bid due to bid mistakes, and in such cases, the final determination to grant such relief rests with the governing agency in accordance with public contracts code. So that would still have be required to come to your board. County Council is instrumental in preparation of the policy, and our departments will consult with County Council when implementing the policy. Some of the benefits of the policy include that it provides a single countywide procedure that will provide uniformity in the process that General Services and Public Works use to handle bid protests. Final decision regarding protests, as indicated previously, is delegated to the department head level. This avoids the need for a hearing before your board, eliminating the requirement that your board listen and sift through details and render a decision for future protests. The intent in developing the policy was to provide for a ministerial evaluation of protests, and a complete process for timing for a final protest hearing, if appropriate, by the department head. And that this final determination is subsequently made part of your board's adoption of the contract award action. And it's felt that General Services Agency and Public Works Department have the staff and resources and expertise to sort through and evaluate the details of a protest and to provide a forum for interested parties to understand and participate in a fair and open process. While the policy delegates the final determination on the protest to the department head, the decision for final award of the contract rests with your board. The department head will make the determination on the technical merits of the protest and provide a final evaluation in writing. The department will bring this package to your board under a consent agenda item for adoption, typically. And if some concern is raised by one or more of the board members, your board can elect to pull the item from the agenda for clarification by staff, or in a worst-case scenario, provide direction for rejection of all bids and re-advertisement consistent with the policy. So looking ahead, provided that your board adopts the policy, Public Works Department will bring forward a Flood Control and Water Conservation District version of the policy on an upcoming consent agenda. And if adopted, Public Works and General Services will include the policy in subsequent bid documents for future contract advertisements, either as a hard copy attachment to the contract or by reference with a link to the document on the county website. However, there will be a transition time as those contracts that were recently approved for advertisement would not be covered by the policy. And the steering committee provided direction that a similar policy will be developed for protests associated with advertisements for professional services contracts. And General Services and Public Works will be working together in the coming months to refine and enhance our current procedures for bid advertisement and processing and responding to bidder inquiries and bid openings. So it's our recommendation that your honorable board approve the attached policy governing bid protests of construction contracts and direct staff to process future construction bids under this policy. And this concludes staff's presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might. The time frame for putting together your final bid comes down to the wire, and there's a lot of documents to gather up and prices to come in and reporting to do, forms to fill out, etc. So there's a likelihood that a contractor will make a mistake, and we usually figure that we reference that as an irregularity. So many of those irregularities are waivable, and we have language in the contract that allows us to waive these non-material irregularities. But I would say almost every bid we have irregularities with one or more of the bidders. Sometimes the bidder is bidder number seven, and it doesn't really matter, but sometimes it's bidder number one. Sometimes the other bidders, especially bidder number two, is relieved that they weren't the low bidder when they see what the prices came in at or whatnot. They don't file a protest, and other times they're just separated by a few $100s, and it would make sense for bidder number two to file a protest and see if you can prevail. So it is complicated, the environment that we're in now, and we try as hard as we can to make everybody bidding on the same level and make the contracts really clear.
And I understand both concepts there, but I guess one thing I'm wondering is what kind of – have we done any outreach to a lot of the contractors or the people that are bidding on these – large projects? Usually you see the same big guys bidding on these things, and they're pretty sophisticated when it comes to contract documents. And I'm wondering if there is maybe some commonality to any of the problems that they may see that we could address to make our contract arrangements much more strong, I guess you'd say, so that we don't have that against the county. Now, I can understand the other part of it. A lot of times if you have a large contract and somebody's just under, they're going to go ahead and file the protest and then try to find some reason to get that thing through. So I understand that, but I want to make sure that we're on solid footing with the way we establish our contracts.
Yes. As an example, for our federal aid projects funded by FHWA. The FHWA, the Federal Highway Administration, has made changes in the disadvantaged business enterprise participation and made the public agencies that are accessing those funds have goals for participation. And at one point, a few years back, the goals were mandatory that we set these goals. And it was for underutilized disadvantaged business enterprise, which was a subset of the overall disadvantaged business enterprise program. And so we did our best to communicate the difference with our first project that we had bid under these new requirements. And the bids that we received, there were errors in every single, almost every bid of the low four or five bidders. And I hate more than anything to bring to you a recommendation to reject all bids and rebid, because it's not fair for anybody. It delays the project, and the bidders have their prices out for everybody else to see and all the work they've had to do to prepare it. But in that instance, it was apparent that we needed to do a better job of communication and outreach with the contracting community, and so we did. We had mandatory outreach meetings for our next, at least our next bid project under those rules, and the bids that came in were a lot better, and we were able to award to the apparent low bidder on the next project. So,
if I may, Mr. Sure. Chairman, I'd like to briefly respond to Supervisor Meacham's question and comment, and I think his point is well taken. Is obviously some bid protests are going to be unavoidable, as it's somewhat the nature of the beast, but what can we do on our end to help ensure that our documents are as tight as possible so that we might not be inadvertently contributing to that problem? And I think that's something we can take a look at. Obviously, this team is focused on when a protest does occur, how do we want to handle that? But I think as far as process improvement goes, we can do some digging on both our departments about how can we make a more robust set of bid documents going forward, and possibly including reaching out to some of our developers, as you noted.
Right. Supervisor Arnold?
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Wirst. I had a couple of comments, and I know that there's been bid protest increases. I would blame partly due to the economy and the more competitive nature of trying to go after these public works jobs, but also, as you stated, the increased complexity of the criteria on bidding for public jobs. A percentage of your certain materials have to be bought in a certain place from certain people and so forth and so on. It gets very complex. And I know that compiling those bids is no small job, as you pointed out. Oops, that was just a mistake, but overlook that. It makes a difference to all the bidders if someone's going to be allowed to make mistakes and then just those mistakes are overlooked. So did I understand you correctly that in those cases that it will come up to our level to be reviewed, or how does that work in the new policy?
I think I'll defer that question to Pat Ferran from Council.
Patrick Ferran, Deputy County Council. In the event a bidder seeks to have relief from its own bid on the ground of the bidder's mistake, that will come back to the board only in the instance where the department head has agreed with the bidder's claim of mistake. The statute allows a bidder to be relieved from mistake only when the legislative body approves the relief on the grounds of mistake. So that's why there's an exception from the policy that if someone does claim a mistake and wants to get relieved from their bid and the department head agrees with that, then it goes to the board. If the department head says, no, this is not a mistake that's recognized under the law as a valid grounds of mistake, then that will not come to the board, and the mistake will be denied at the department head level. But if it is approved as a mistake, it will come to you for final approval. And as far as mistakes go, the law generally is clear that we're only talking about clerical errors, like in arithmetic or things like that. Errors in judgment are not grounds for mistake for being relieved from a bid. And there's a lot of case law on the issue, and it gets a little complicated because every case is fact-oriented. But that's the mistake issue in a nutshell.
So... And I think that's important because some of the public bids that I've seen since I came on the board were things like criteria that was expected or demanded in the original bid wasn't met quite the same way that everyone else understood it had to be met. So it affects the bid, the pricing. It affects the bid that the contractor is putting in. If a contractor can be kind of loose with the bid, and then that's decided at the department head level, I mean, I just see that opens up a can of worms that would create uncertainty for everyone that's trying to bid in a fair process. So are we talking clerical errors? To me, is misspelled words or numbers that weren't tabulated right, but judging between, oh, that was just a mistake, or, oh, you did that on purpose to give you an advantage to get this bid, you know, become the top bidder so we would be focused on you, that's quite another thing.
Well, and your question points out the very reason why these issues do become very fact-oriented and involved, and that's why this policy is before your board, because those type of questions do come down to often a judgment call in which the department head will be consulting with county council, because these are often gray areas of law, and it's a tough call sometimes. But the department head will be consulting with county council, and both the department head and the county council have a vested interest in making a decision that is not challengeable in court, and each department head has their own vested interest in building the project and not being delayed by a court action. So both the department head and county council have a very strong interest in getting it right.
I understand that. I'm still wrestling with the fact that we've seen, and I've seen it here since I've been on the board too, where a contractor may feel like he was treated a little bit unfairly, but it's not worth the money and time to take it to court. So I guess I think it's just my concern that this is a fair process, that our contractors know that it's very fair. And I wonder, you mentioned that by law, a bid mistake, a judgment on that kind of thing is supposed to come before the elected body? Or?
The statute does state that if a bidder is going to be relieved of its bid on the grounds of mistake, that final decision should be before the legislative body. And that's why that's the one exception to this whole policy, because of that one statute. But that's only a situation where the bidder, him or herself, is coming before us saying, we want to be relieved of our bid. We know we're the low bidder, but we don't want the contract. And they want to get out of the contract.
Okay.
That's the only exception.
But if we're going the other direction, like the example I gave you before where someone's said, okay, we didn't have this criteria fulfilled in the way that everyone else did, and therefore we are lower, but we didn't quite understand the rules. And they are the low bidder. We won't, in other words, it's considered a mistake, I guess. Sometimes I know it's interpretation, but we wouldn't be able to weigh in on that just to make sure that there's a larger body looking.
That is correct. In the area of the public contract code, the term mistake is limited to situations where the bidder, him or herself, is seeking relief from their low bid on the grounds that they made a mistake.
Okay.
I wonder, are you comfortable with the idea there, Mr. Meacham?
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to point out, too, is that oftentimes when these come before the board, and no disrespect to any of my colleagues, but sometimes we don't understand that.
You have appropriate checks and balances between your board's responsibilities and staff's work. And just to be a little more specific, the board would still, when a contract is to be awarded, that would go to your board for approval. If your board had concerns at that point in time, those could be aired and we could...
Or bids could be rejected.
Or bids be rejected. Well, I'd also have to come back to your board. Right. So those are opportunities for final approval.
Mr. Meacham?
And just my final comment. I have no problem moving forward with this. As long as we have the ability to continue to look for the means to really stabilize our contract arrangement so that we're on firm footing, make sure that we're not making the same mistake, if you will. Thank you.
Okay. Continuous process improvement. I will open it to the public. I have no request to speak, so I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board, and entertain a motion.
I'll move staff's recommendation.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Mr. Hill, no further discussion. Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. Our next item is closed session. Again, I have no request to speak on closed session, so I will close it to the public and ask counsel for an estimate of time.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Counsel. I would estimate 45 minutes
today. All right.
Today.
Thank you. And we will reconvene at 1:30. Thanks. Thank you, Madam Clerk. We're reconvening the July 16th meeting of the Board of Supervisors. Madam Counsel, and report out of closed session.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Counsel. The Board did meet in closed session, and no reportable action was taken.
Thank you very much. With that, we do have one resolution on presentation. I'd entertain a motion on that.
So moved.
Second? Second. Thank you. Mr. Hill, Ms. Arnold, and a roll call, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham? And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Before we do the resolution, the first item on our agenda is a presentation by the 21st Class of Leadership SLO. And I would invite that esteemed organization and its current class before us. Introduce yourself, please, and let us know what you're working on.
Terrific. Thank you very much for having us. So I'm Amanda Collins, obviously one of the members of the 21st class of San Luis Obispo County. I have a couple other class members with me here today. Amy Wyatt, who works with RTA. Linda Parker-Sompe, who owns Parker-Sompe Public Relations. And Liz Ruth. So we're here today as I'm not sure how familiar you are or not, but one of the tasks of the leadership class is to come up with a legacy project so that after our class has completed its process and gone through the year of learning about the county, we can leave a lasting impression that will benefit the county and our residents. So through our exploration process, we looked at a number of ideas, but it came to our attention that the county window at the state capitol is outdated, to say the least. So that really spawned a lot of conversation in how do we get going and how can we make that our project to update it. So just to give you an idea of where we are with that current display, this is an image of the current display. It has some pieces, but we think it's a really great opportunity to bring it up to date. Our county has come so far since this display was last updated, and we really want to show what all that we have to offer. So with that...
Is it a koala? What is it?
It was very fortuitous timing that some of the recent media picked up that we had this need, and we were actually very fortunate in being able to respond to them and kind of let them know where we were in the process. We have created an RFP to be sent out throughout the county. Within that RFP, there's a few things to know. We wanted to talk about the four primary attractions that should definitely be represented in the visual representation of this window. And then additionally talked about how respondents to the RFP should be residents of San Luis Obispo County, really emphasizing that pride in where we live and how we promote it. What we're looking for, I guess, is kind of support from you guys. It's really more moral support than financial support. We've been very fortunate in that we presented a visit San Luis Obispo County. They, as an organization, agreed that with your support to move forward with this project, they would fund up to $12,000. And then within our class, we've committed up to $2,000. The $14,000 budget was created working with the art professionals within our class to talk about what would it take to execute this project, execute it in a very professional manner. And then additionally, we kind of looked at what some other recent counties had done and their budgets. And with those adjustments, that's where we came to really $10,000 to $15,000. We feel very comfortable with that $14,000 amount. It's also plan to include any contingencies that may come up at the last minute and also include installation and transportation of the display up to the state capitol. So through the RFP process, we want to make sure that we are involving all voices of the county.
About this, and this, all the years that I worked for Assemblyman Blakeslee, I walked up and down the halls and I would always look at our display and think, oh, we've got to do something about this, update it, just like you said. So I'm excited about this project, but knowing that Supervisor Meacham is an alumni of the leadership program, I would nominate him to be the.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Madam Clerk.
A little discussion.
It's called the rail. It's called the railroad there.
Actually, yes, I was a member of Class 5, the class by which all others are judged. I would be more than happy to, and Vicki Shelby's probably shooting arrows at me right now for volunteering another one, but I'd be happy to work with the leadership group. Wonderful. On this.
Excellent.
And we'll support you morally.
Yeah, that we can do. I know this has been something that leadership has considered for a little while here, and I think it's a great project. I'm in and out of that the legislative offices on a semi-regular basis, and I too have noticed with some wistfulness. Ours might be best considered a classic diorama. Sitting next to Santa Barbara County's high-definition video screen.
I've heard it's quite the contrast.
And I've had at least one Santa Barbara County supervisor essentially rub it in seriously as we walk down the hall there. So I think this is a great project. I'll look forward to seeing all the creative ideas that come forward. I'll thank Mr. Meacham in advance for his commitment and wish him well with his legislative assistant. And with that, we will look forward to a report when next we might have one.
All right, wonderful. Thank you so much for all of your support.
A pleasure. Thank you, Ms. Collins. All right. Our next item in presentation is the presentation of a resolution, and we've asked Mr. Hill to handle that for us, please.
I see we have quite a few of our members of the status commission of status of women. I don't know if you all want to come to the lectern, or Paula, or Jan, or whoever. This is a resolution recognizing Jan Potter. Jan passed away not too long ago, a few months back. When exactly did Jan pass away? Earlier this year, right?
In January, yeah.
She was a real, I'm sure they'll speak to it, she was a real figure in our community, and many people know her from her house, her extraordinary house, where she hosted Christmas parties for the commission and for League of Women Voters. She was a real fixture. So this is a resolution recognizing Jan Potter as the Commission of Status Woman of the Year 2012. Whereas the San Luis Obispo County Commission on the Status of Women has chosen Jan Potter to receive its 2012 Woman of the Year Award, the Commission is honoring Ms. Potter's lifelong commitment serving the County of San Luis Obispo. Ms. Potter was a vivacious and valuable and dedicated commissioner on the County of San Luis Obispo Commission of Status of Women for longer than she could remember. And whereas Ms. Potter effected positive change in the lives of all she touched through her involvement in and support of programs supporting women's equality, services for victims of domestic violence and abuse, financial and legal education for divorcees, and children's welfare. Ms. Potter served as a judge for History Day and developed a local classroom program, including slides, lectures, and presentations in the 1870s historical costume. Ms. Potter will be greatly missed by current and past members of the Commission on the Status of Women, and I think we could say by all who were lucky enough to know her in our county. So therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize Jan Potter for receiving the Commission on the Status of Women 2012 Woman of the Year Award. And you guys want to come up and get this? And maybe.
Well, she has her family here.
Oh, okay. So is there, that would be wonderful.
Yes.
Maybe, does anybody have a camera? Do you want a picture?
A picture. It would be our pleasure. Indeed, I had the pleasure of attending a couple of those functions at Ms. Potter's house, and lively and vivacious is exactly her. So,
you want to come on up for
bring the traditional backdrop?
Yeah, we'll serve as a backdrop for the Potters here.
But he's at his own supervisor meeting in
Clark
County.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's right. Jan told us about that. Yeah. That's right.
And he had his own meeting.
That's right. That's right. I remember that.
Yeah. He is a force.
Yeah. So why don't you guys say a few things about Jan?
And we are just so proud of Jan. She was our commissioner emeritus because she had been with us for so long. She was also our guiding spirit on the commission. She served as our parliamentarian and kept us in order. And she reminded us of our history, where we had come from, and talked about where we were going to. And we really wanted to follow Jan's example in so many things. She really was the role model and a mentor for so many of us. One of the first women that I met on the commission after coming on board. And she was someone that just took you under her wing like she had known you forever and was so welcoming, her, like you said, her home, but her heart was the place that really was the home that we all felt so close to. We just, all of us received a badge when we came on the commission because Jan took care of getting the badges for us. So she was the thread that knitted us all together and connected us to so much more of the community. So we really have lost a pioneer for the community. I know she made history exciting and delightful for people of all ages, which isn't easy, particularly for children. And we also lost a champion for the Commission on the Status of Women. So on behalf of the Commission, I would very much like to present this very small token to you. I mean, nothing can really say really how we felt about Jan and what she did for us and how she just really made the Commission something of importance for women and girls within this community. So we just present you with this award, and we want to just thank you so much for sharing your mother with us for a small period of time. We also, I would also like to ask Paula Upperhide if she would come forward and just say even a few more words. She was so close to Jan, and it's just an honor and a privilege if you give us a moment to have her also share just a few words about Jan. And thank you so much.
Certainly. Ms. Upperhide.
Yeah, I was so thankful to call Jan my friend, but the word friend doesn't describe the relationship I had with her. It's more like mentor, mother, confidant, and fellow commissioner. Jan followed her heart, and it took her in many directions in our community. She loved history, as we've said, and that took her into lots of fourth grade classes all over our community. For 15 plus years, she volunteered to go into those classrooms, and she would dress up in her period costume, as Paul was talking about, and she would act as though she had come through a time travel into their classroom. And she was from the early days of California, asking teachers questions like, where is your board of understanding? And, I didn't see the stable where the children had put their horses today. Her goal was to bring history alive for children, and I am sure there are people watching this meeting today who sat through some of her fourth grade classes and watched her do her presentation. She spent many years working as a docent at the Mission San Luis Obispo and was always concerned about its history, the preservation of it, and the accuracy of it. She had a passion for helping women. After a difficult divorce, she was very aware of how little she knew about her finances and how vulnerable women can be after a marriage. And so she took her pain into action. With her Women's Community Center, which started out as the Women's Resource Center, she was a founding member of the board, wanting women in San Luis Obispo to have a place to where they could get information and help if they needed it. She wanted to use her knowledge that she had learned through her divorce to help other women who didn't have the money to get good advice. So for 15 plus years, she conducted divorce classes helping women in our county with information referrals to organizations that could help her. She was one of the longest standing commissioners for District 3. If she had lived to June 1, she would have served on the commission for 15 years. The commission, with her help on the Commission of the Status of Women, she helped to bring many informative programs to the women of our county and worked hard to inform our supervisors on issues that were facing our county. And she is the reason that I applied to become a commissioner. She loved San Luis Obispo. She wanted the best for San Luis Obispo County. So she took her activism and her ability to organize teas and coffees to help political candidates in our county, to meet and greet people of San Luis Obispo. Many people in our county running for sheriff, supervisor, assemblyman, and senators have had teas at Jan's house. Many of you sitting in these seats have had teas at Jan's house to help you with your campaign. She loved her home, and she felt blessed to have the best citizen of this county, working for over 40 years for women and children, and that's why we honor her today. But for me, I honor her as a great friend, and I miss her. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Efferhide. And thanks to all of you who have come to remember a remarkable woman, and I appreciate very much the time we've taken to get a little glimpse into some other aspects of her life that not all of us knew. So we hold her dear in our memory.
And thanks for being here.
Thank you,
Board. Okay. Send our regards to Pete.
Yeah. The son, I didn't catch your name, but Vivian's son is Supervisor Pete Vanderpool of Tulare County, who's hard at work, I'm sure, even as we speak today.
Yeah,
so,
you're closer.
Yeah, right. With that, we'll come to the last item on our presentation calendar, which is the submittal of the annual report of the Commission on Aging. And we have esteemed members, including its chair, Ms. Kathleen Bellefontaine. We also have Carol Schmidt and Alice York here who have speaker slips. Ms. Bellefontaine, a pleasure to see you again.
And pleasure to be here. With a little sadness, I must say, because the last time I was here, Paul Teixeira was also here. So I'm missing him. My exciting report here should be in front of you. And I want to start out by saying, what you've already said, I'm Kathleen Bellefontaine, and I'm chair for the Commission on Aging. And usually when I come in here, the minute I say aging, everybody up there kind of goes to sleep. So I want to call it something a little bit different this afternoon. And that's the Commission on Living a Long Life with Dignity. So is that better? A commission on living a long life with dignity. Because that really is the essence of what the commission is about. And so you have two parts in your report here. And just to be real brief about it, on the first page, you will find at the bottom what our priority issues are. One paragraph gives you our priority issues. And when you skip over to the table, that's within that part one, you see all of the activities and ways that we have tried to take action about the priorities that we've chosen to focus on for the year. And then when you get to the next section, you actually get what our plans are for the new fiscal year. So you have our priority issues to look at for just starting the new circle. So that's just a brief overall annual report, and I want to then go on with something that's not so brief, and I want to give you a little more meat. First of all, we do this needs assessment. That's how we came up with the priority issues for the fiscal years, and we primarily look at the categories of affordability, which are for the essentials, food, medical care, shelter, transportation. Within that, we, you know, try to focus on the things that are the most, that are on the minds of the members at that time and their peers. But we're looking at affordability issues. We're looking at safety issues. So we often have presentations that include elder abuse, other scams, hoarding. I mean, we're looking at the safety of our elders. And we look at hope. Hope, retaining your independence and dignity, which throughout is what this is all about. So in little handout that I gave you, I think you should note a fact about San Luis Obispo County, because this California Elder Economic Index details SLO County in 2011. And if you notice the second paragraph in, no matter what the source of income is in this community, many seniors struggle to make ends meet. Actually, in 2007, it was 45% of our seniors in this county. I don't have the most up-to-date percentage. So a few years ago, it was 45% of our county that was struggling to make ends meet, seniors. So the Commission on Aging will always be looking at how this county can meet the essentials of the needs of the most vulnerable seniors. That's always going to be there. And we're always aware and thankful for the existing federal, state, county funding that are supporting these things and the high volume of volunteers. I mean, if we didn't have the volunteers delivering those meals, the volunteers going to Los Angeles, I could go on and on, San Francisco. They came here in the 80s, 90s, and of course they're still coming. But the point is when they came here, they were people that had worked hard all of their life. They had planned ahead. They felt that they bought a place that they could afford and live within their means. And, of course, they came to the most beautiful place on the coast. And they brought up our economy here in San Luis Obispo County. So what is happening now, though, is that we are seeing the mobile home parks that will be sold to landowners who will want to use the land for something else. Where will those seniors go? Because, again, they're on fixed incomes. Many of these people are in their 80s and 90s. Where are they going to go if they need to move out of those mobile homes? Others are those people living in their own single-family homes, people that have aged in their single-family homes. They're not able to keep themselves up safely anymore. They're going to need places to go. And guess what? The housing for assisted living is very low in our community. So that is something that, of course, we can't solve overnight. But it is something that we cannot neglect to look at, that we do not have affordable housing in this county for the multiple people that are going to want to make these moves or have to make these moves. So somebody's got to look out for these folks. And looking out for seniors who are most vulnerable, that's what the Commission on Aging is all about. Thank you for letting me speak so long.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Belfontaine, and the
Any questions about that?
Questions on affordable housing? I know you're well connected with other departments within the county, and our planning and building department has taken on issues of mobile home parks, and we certainly appreciate your calling that again to our attention, as we know it's a very important element of stability in a long and fruitful life. And so we thank you for your attention to it. I also have slips from Ms. Carol Schmidt and Ms. Alice York, who might want to speak on other issues surrounding the commission's work. Greetings, Ms. Schmidt.
Carol Schmidt. I'm a member of the commission and former program director of senior peer counseling. When I left my job in 2010, I segued into volunteering because I firmly believe that that's the best thing anybody can do. My primary interest has always been the older adults in the community. That's what the program I ran focused on. My sister programs under Wilshire Community Services, Caring Callers, Good Neighbor, even Creating Mediation has a family mediation arm now where they do elder family mediation. So the focus on the well-being and the quality of life for older adults has been very high on my list of important things. The commission's role in the community, I think, is so critical in that when I talk about the commission when I'm out doing my presentations, I talk about it as a conduit. Citizens can come to us. They can learn things from the presentations we give. We can learn things from them about their needs and their concerns. The public does come, and they do express their concerns, and then we take those concerns to you, and then you give us back information. So it's a great way to have an open communication, which I think is so important for people. My primary volunteer activity under the Wilshire Community Services umbrella now is, I made them give me business cards, Volunteer Community Liaison. Because what I want to do is go out into the community at every possible venue and talk to people about the life of the older adult in the community, about services that can be provided, about how those services get provided, and always talking about volunteerism. I think that one of the biggest challenges is going to be, and is currently, securing the volunteers that are going to be wanting to do these things for people. Senior peer counseling, luckily, has just started a new training, so we've got those people coming on board. But there's always a need for volunteers in every area. And the whole idea of the commission and a way to inspire people to come and check us out, I think across the board, when you retire, you have more time, but volunteering can be for people that are still working. There's a ton of need out there, and without the volunteers, we're really going to be hard-pressed to provide these on-the-ground services. I mean, volunteers can't do a whole lot about housing, Habitat for Humanity excluded, but in terms of supporting people and making people aware of what's available and what the needs are, the volunteers are critical. And I always say that, and I also say if you don't want to work with older adults, there's puppies, there's babies, there's trees, there's an endless need. So that's the biggest challenge. And so for people that are looking and watching or listening, think about what you're doing. Is there a place in your life for a little volunteering? It doesn't have to be much. Just an hour here and there can make a huge difference in an older adult's life. Rocking. You can tell them across the board, there's hundreds and hundreds of, I think they have 215 stations, police, hospital, government, everywhere, schools. And you fill out some paperwork, and then you just have a great party once a month, once a year. That's the best way to do it. And I don't have the phone number off the top of my head, but it's the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program.
Through any of our offices, we can get folks in touch.
And so thank you so much for that question.
Well, my pleasure. I think very highly of RSVP. You know, it's good not only for those who receive the benefits of the volunteers, but for the seniors that volunteer and thus contribute to the fruitfulness of a long life. So
people are a lot happier if they volunteer.
Very good.
And the commission meets on the third Friday of the month from 10 to noon at the Vets Hall if anybody wants to come.
Very good. Thanks. Ms. York? Another of our very active members of the commission on a long life, fruitfully lived.
Good afternoon, supervisors. I'm Alice York. I am Supervisor Gibson's representative on the SLO Commission on Aging. I'm also the chairman of the Hearing Advocacy Committee. And I want to just, before I get into my little thing, if there's still some time,
sure.
This clock says 3 minutes. It said that the whole time. So I guess it's okay. I was an elementary teacher for 20 years, and when we retired and came up here, I knew I still wanted to do something. And to me, the two areas of our population that need help the most are the children and the seniors. And I figure, okay, 20 years, I've already done the kids. I'm going to go to the other end of the spectrum, although I have done cuddling also, which is the neonatal. But I first of all want to thank Supervisor Gibson for his efforts to upgrade our audio system at the Vets Hall, so that as part of our hearing advocacy program, we do now have a microphone so that people that are at our meeting can hear each other. And so we really appreciated that. And also just the promotion, promotion from you people on establishing a hearing-friendly committee. We try to say as we go out talking to people about this that San Luis was the first county to ban smoking, so maybe we could be the first community to really encourage people to be aware of hearing loss. And I'm not going to go into that whole program, but we do have we are working hard on that. We have limited people on our group. We're not a huge organization that has lots of members, but it's something we keep working on. As a recent volunteer to the Meals on Wheels program in Morro Bay, my husband and I went from delivering meals as substitute drivers to working in the office, and I just wanted to add that this has been such another awakening for me. The commission has taught me so much, and I am so amazed at the resources that are out there. And, of course, they need the funding. But being in the office now with Meals on Wheels, I see the needs of so many people in Morro Bay to stay in their home and what our volunteers need to be doing and can be doing. So I just wanted to say that I support Carol with the volunteers. If you're not 55, if you're under 55, what you could do is go online and look at RSVP's list of places to volunteer and then go on your own and do that. So there is a way you can do it, and there are so many places that would appreciate your help. So thank you for your support of the commission. I think we're really trying to do an important job in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. York. And thanks to you and Ms. Schmidt, Ms. Bellefontaine, and all the members of the commission, which does meet on the third Friday of every month, San Luis Obispo Vets Hall at 10 in the morning. And we commend you for your work and commend any who are interested in senior issues to get in touch with the commission. So with that, thanks again. And we will move on to our items for the afternoon. Thanks also to the members of the Commission on the Status of Women for being with us here this afternoon. Madam Clerk, would you introduce our next item, please? We'll be.
Item number 30, a hearing to consider an appeal of the Templeton Area A Road Improvement Fee by Mike and Nancy Harris, District 1.
Mr. Honeycutt, when you're ready, I assume you're the presenter there. Yeah. Mr. Harris will be with you as soon as we get the staff report. I'll invite you to the
lecture. Templeton proper is the yellow area. And the applicant is wanting to build a home and a detached garage there on Old County Road. A little over a block from the downtown park in one direction and about that far from the Templeton Elementary School. This here is a chronology of events for the application process. It's similar to what is in the staff report, except for the item there in the middle, which is a theoretical item that didn't actually happen. So the applicant came in on May 15th, applied for permits. The permits made its way through the process, arrived to Public Works on the 21st, and then we return the permits on the 29th. Now, what we would normally do in our process, somewhere between the 21st and the 29th, and I put 23rd there plus or minus, is we would typically write a letter, send it certified mail to the applicant saying that your project requires a road fee, and we would say the amount, and there is a discussion there that if they had a problem with that they could appeal the process. However, even though we usually do it, it didn't happen this time. Not quite sure why, but we're pretty sure it did not happen. Consequently, with our review comments, one of the items in the review comments was to say that the fee was due and what the amount was. On June 5th, the applicant picked up the plan check comments, which there were a number of items to address. One of those was the fee amount, so this would be the first time that the applicant apparently was aware of the road improvement fee. And then a couple weeks later, the applicant applied for an appeal on this on the fee. The applicant said that he did get this form, and you're not really meant to be able to read the whole thing there. But this would be an item that the planning department typically hands out when you apply for a building permit. And there are a number of items they would check, certain things that would be needed. One of those items would be the road improvement fee, because the project is in one of the areas. It's not necessarily told which one. And if you can see in the middle side, there's a double dollar sign. In the attempt to be helpful, that double dollar sign appears on almost every item on the list in the background. But it refers to that note at the top, which I've made easier to read. And if you have that double dollar sign behind the item, then you're directed to go ask for the specific cost there. As you can tell, there is no, well, you don't know the fee unless you ask. In the appeals process, the fee and the appeal process are covered in Section 19 of the county or 13 of the county code, and the basis for a waiver generally tied to the nexus is the fee based on the traffic amount and does the traffic actually exist for that project. And so the appellant did prepare a letter, which is included in the staff report. There are a number of points that were raised. I've paraphrased those points. I think I did them well, but Mr. Harris can later tell us if he had a different point. The first point is that the appellant believes that there used to be a home on this parcel that burned down some number of years ago. Which is an important point, that if we were building a new structure to replace an old one, then the new traffic demand would look a lot like the old traffic demand. We would not need to charge a fee. However, we've looked at aerial photos dating back as into the 60s. The one that's here that's kind of hard to read because it's copied off of a true blueprint, which is very blue. There is no house there, as shown here, say, in 1988. So we were not able to find any evidence. We also checked the permit files. They don't go back very far, but cannot find any evidence of a permit in recent history that would cover a home on that site. So it's our finding that this would be a new home, which would create a new traffic demand and therefore be subject to the fee. The second point raised by the appellant is that the fee creates a hardship, and partly due to a loss of job and some significant health issues. And while we are sensitive to those issues, these are not addressed on the criteria for a fee waiver, which would allow them to pay the permit later. They have to sign an agreement. They have to work something out with the bank, come in second after their loan or after the fee. And so out of those two choices, the appellant was made aware of these. And finally, the appellant is also appealing the appeal fee of $513 because he did not know or did not understand that there would be a fee charged. The fee itself for this process is basically to cover staff time to bring this issue to you. Over the history of this program that was started in 1991, there have been a total of 22 appeals brought to this board. 11 of those, half, were denied. 7 of them were adjusted, and 4 were waived. And so at this point, it's staff's recommendation that you deny both the waiver of the fee and the appeal fee. And I'm happy to address any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Honeycutt. Questions for Mr. Honeycutt from colleagues? All right. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. With that, Mr. Harris, invite you to come to the lectern as the appellant. We welcome a presentation from you on your case. You have up to 10 minutes. We hope that's adequate.
Yeah, I'd like to address a couple of actually the issues as far as I may just start with this. Thank you, Board, for having me up here. On the apparent portion of where there was no structure on the property before, I'd like to just kind of start in with that one. I know it's kind of backing in. There was a property that was a structure on there before. My contractor has been out there, and they were doing some scraping of the lot. And upon scraping the lot, I have a picture I could pass along. They showed we found sewer, water, and gas on the property. So if there was no apparent structure on the property in years past, then I wouldn't assume that there would be sewer, water, and gas in place. And I don't know if you want to look at this, and I'll pass along several pictures. It shows the lot.
And, Ms. Harris, we will keep that for the clerk's record, if that's all
right. Yes, you can have that. As far as the complete process, when we started the process several years ago, you know, we were going to build a single-family residence in downtown Templeton. We had come into it with, we knew it was going to be a limited budget. I'd had some major health issues coming into play, and we were wanting to downsize. So I tried to do my due diligence as far as determining costs that would work within our budget and be able to move through with this project. We were going to have a general contractor do the whole process, but as things went along, we realized we needed to do owner-builder just to save costs. We did purchase the property in Templeton prior to submitting the permit. We needed to purchase a lot. Our lender did require line item listing of what it was going to take to complete the project, what the lot price was. And so I'd gone to the county's website, and I looked to try to determine what fees would be, what our material costs would be, what the construction costs would be for the project. The only thing I could find on road fees that came up on the checklist as far as what the planning department site had was road fee may vary. I was told one fee that the fee could be between $600 and $800. So that's what I put in my line item to our lender in order to obtain our financing. We submitted for the permit as soon as we'd completed then the purchase of the land portion of it with our lender. Financing would not be completely released until the permit process was over and we had the permit in our hand. Then on, I believe it was the date, as he stated, on I think it was May, or the first time that I was aware of the fee was May 21st when we had our plan review checklist after submitting plans with Mr. Dummett, our architect. And Mr. Dummett brought it to my attention that, it looks like you have a fee here also of $13,921 for a road assessment. And I said, well, this was never presented up front. No one ever, you know, if it's a fee of that significant, it's something I think should be presented up front so a person could incorporate it into their budget in order to get their loan. Our loan was already locked. We had no way of going back. We had no further cash. So that's where I was saying it put me into a catch-22 situation. Basically, I couldn't get the permit till I had the cash to pay that fee. Without the permit, my lender would not release the funds. I had to do a short-term loan interim off somebody in order to pay that fee to pick up the permit last week, and then I'll pay the person back. I mean, we only were qualifying for a certain amount of money, but by the time it got to that point, it was already too late. We couldn't change the loan at that point. It was locked. And there was no way to add another $14,000, which is far exceeds the cost of the permits in general. And just to put things in perspective, even the cost, just in general, to building this can have totaled up everything as far as engineering, architectural, all the little fees in between, with this fee added on top, and with the water meter fees in Templeton and everything else that's been put into play with it, it has cost me so far $81,000, and I haven't even dug in the dirt yet. And which seems a little steep to me. I mean, I've done an owner builder back in 96. It's been a long time, and I never, ever remember it costing that much. So, yeah, maybe I went into it a little green, but I'm not a developer. And as far as, road impact goes, I can't see that a 1,200-square-foot residential home is going to have a major road impact in Templeton. In fact, it's going to be better off for us because our daughter goes to the school in Templeton, and she'll be walking now rather than me driving her. So I won't even be pulling out of my driveway as far as the road impact goes. And maybe there should be an adjustment to this fee in the sense of it should be based on square footage of the home. If someone builds a 10,000-square-foot home, it's the same fee. If you're building a 1,200-square-foot home, it's the same fee. If you were doing a commercial building somewhere, in downtown Templeton, which is going to have far more impact on the community as far as road use, maybe the fee should be determined a little higher for that then. There should be a balance. I mean, the school fees are based on $2.96 a square foot, which is fair. You're paying by what you're using. This fee seems to be straight across the board and doesn't take into consideration anything in the size of the home or the price of the project. And it's a significant amount of our project for what we're trying to do. And so I really don't know what else could be said about it as far as that, other than I felt it was very unjust that it wasn't a fee that should have been presented up front and saying, by the way, before you get into this, be aware that there will be a fee of $13,921 before you pick up your permit, and you may want to take that into consideration, which I had nothing presented to me as they stated. There was no letter sent. Nobody had mentioned. I didn't know I was the double dollar sign meant go back to the counter and make sure you ask. I started asking my subcontractors, my architect, who have been building in the county for 30 to 40 years, and hoping to get some answers, but they didn't even know. So that's kind of where it's all at with what I
all right. Think.
How I felt about the whole thing. And, you know, it's not the matter that I don't think there should be a fee. It's just I think the fee is pretty, you know, exorbitant as far as the cost of it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harris. Appreciate your thoughts. First, any questions from colleagues to Mr. Harris at this point? You must stand by for just a second.
Okay, sure.
I am going to open it to the general public. I have no other requests to speak, and so I'll close it to the general public. And in that brief time since we last talked, if you had any further closing comments, you're welcome to that.
Okay,
and
great.
Then we'll
Thank
bring
you.
It back to the board.
Okay.
So with nothing further for you to present, well, thank you for your comments,
okay.
And I'll bring it back to the board for
okay,
deliberation.
Thank you very much.
Defer to the supervisor of the district, Mr. Meacham.
Thank you. Just a couple of things. I went back and was looking over the different forms as well. And I guess from a procedural standpoint, Frank, or Mr. Honeycutt, when you see something that says additional fees, road fees, fee varies. And you indicated that one has to ask if, in fact, there would be a fee. At what point does that take place?
I'm sorry, you're asking when would they ask?
Well, I'm asking when should they have asked? Because if they take their application out for a permit and it says road fees vary, I would assume that we would tell somebody either you may have a fee that would be due or there would be fees due. I mean, and that makes a big difference because if you were to tell someone you may have some fees due here because of the road fees vary, then I would think that there would be some type of a range to say that they could be X to Y, Z, whatever. But if it says that there may be fees and then they don't hear anything, they may assume that there aren't any at that point. So where in the process is this solidified?
I think in this case, it's my understanding that the applicant was given this list. Perhaps looking at the list would be to ask what those fees are. Now, he's indicated that he went to a number of sources, Templeton CSD, his architect, builder, whatever. I have no indication.
Standard procedure is then to send notification by way of certified mail. After our review of records, it appears this case of notification was not sent to the applicant. So I guess I'm kind of puzzled at what point do they know? Do they have to ask, or wouldn't that be something that we would tell them that in this particular area of Templeton, and I'm kind of surprised that CSD didn't know this because there's a lot of discussion about that, but at what point would we tell somebody early on so that they can get their financing in place, here's the cost?
Maybe I can help out.
What if we could defer to Ms. Griffin?
Cami Griffin, County Planning and Building. So it really depends on an individual applicant. If an applicant comes in to the front counter and talks with one of the front counter planners or one of the land use technicians there, all of the APNs that have a road fee, whether it be Templeton or South County, are all flagged in our system. And so if someone were to come in and say, so tell me kind of what's going to happen with my property, first thing we do is pull it up in the system and we would say, oh, you've got a South County road fee or whichever road fee. But if someone's trying to do a lot of that by not coming in and talking and just trying to figure it out, you're right, they would click on our handout that's called Guide to Residential Fees, and it's got kind of an estimate for, hey, a normal single-family residence will cost about this much, and under road fee it says, you know, fee varies because we have multiple fees throughout the county. So it really they can find out very early if they come and avail themselves of the information provided through our permit center. But if you tried to do it on your own, it would be a little more difficult to find that out. And then the standard process would happen. You'd file your permit application. It would be referred out. One of the places it would be referred is Public Works, and then they do have their process where they send out that certified letter.
And in regard to the photographs that Mr. Harris presented, it's the first I've seen these, but does that have any conclusion to the fact there was a house there?
It would certainly be evidence that would suggest. I would be surprised, though, that there are utilities to a home, but it doesn't show up on any aerials unless, you know, it got built and burned down in between photos. I don't know. I would point out, though, if it had come to us, again, not as a new use, but a old reuse use or whatever, we would say there's a fee, but the fee would calculate out to zero because there'd be no new impact. So if there is good reason to believe, and this is the first I'm hearing about utilities serving something on that site, if there was a use there, then we at the staff level could say your fee is zero. But up till now, we haven't had any such evidence. So
how do we proceed then if we have evidence that suggests that?
Well, it would seem to me that the key date is 1991, when the road impact fee ordinance went into effect, because it's my understanding, and Public Works can correct me if I'm wrong, that with the establishment of that fee, we are looking to collect funds to mitigate the impact to our road system for development that is new going forward from that time. It's a forward-looking process, right?
Yeah, Dave Flynn with Public Works. That's correct. It is essentially when the program was originally conceived and then adopted, it really was a picture of what occurred in Templeton in 1990 and what were the developable lots that were to occur. You know, from that, the capital program was developed, and then the costs were proportioned out to the trips of those vacant lots at that time. Another consideration, too, though, is when we, say, reduce or eliminate fees in that program, then we need to find out some other external source then to make up the funding to cover the entire capital program for the road impact fees for Templeton.
And, in fact, because of the very significant road improvement project of the Vineyard Drive interchange, we're actually in arrears, and the road impact fees are paying for something that's already been accomplished.
That's correct. So the Templeton moved ahead in 2007 to increase the size of Vineyard Drive to serve the traffic for the area. That was in total about a $9 million project in which we proceeded with financing on that job. The road impact fees are used to pay off that current financing for the project.
Back to you, Mr. Meacham. I would only add in the part of discussion here is that I'm certainly sympathetic with Mr. Harris, both to the complexity of dealing with a variety of fees and to the bottom line as to how those fees add up. There's no doubt that it is expensive. At the same time, we have known the money for a variety of the permit fees up front was posing difficulties to applicants, and so it would seem that one path we could take here would be apply the deferral provisions that we have on the books, which would push back the actual payment of those fees to the finaling of the building. And I'd certainly, Mr. Harris, if you'd like to comment on that.
I'd like to comment actually on the deferral. From what I was told, even from Public Works, you know, as far as filing a deferral fee, it does put a lien against you. Mm-hmm. My lender will not, reestablish our loan if we have a lien against us, even if it was a deferral fee. So it really does us no good, and we're only qualified for X amount of dollars. So as far as getting more funding out of that, even on an appraisal, it wouldn't make any difference in the first place. That's why we borrowed the money to pay the fee in order to get the permit, to get the funding, to move with this project. We've had far too much invested in it at this point to not move forward with it. We stood to lose really a substantial amount of money. I guess, you know, it's back to my original complaint on the whole issue is that, you know, I'm not a builder. So I'm not going to be really aware that this fee was even out there. You know, and nobody put it right out there on the table and told me about it. You know, when I was applying, we did have to apply prior to that in order to get our financing for the property. So this was before the permit was even put in place. That's why I did the research that I could to find out what fees would be involved and what costs would be involved in order to get the loan just for the property. After we got that approval process through and got the funding for the property and the lot was paid for, then we moved on to the permit process. It wasn't until weeks after we applied for the permit that I was even aware of this fee at the plan check stage of it, of the $13,921. By that point, it was too late. Everything was locked down. I there was no going back to the lender and saying, oh, by the way, we missed one line item on your list that we need another $14,000 almost to apply to this loan. Can we qualify for it? It just wasn't going to happen at that point. So it comes right back to the thing that it's something that, you know, shouldn't just say zero to infinity on a fee. There should be some determination. Since this is a set fee, it shouldn't be that tough to put down an exact amount. Apparently, it's the same fee across the board for everyone. So what's the problem with putting it in there somewhere on the website right up front on the checklist to say, by the way, if you're in Templeton District A, this is the fee. If you're in Cayucas, this is the fee. If you're here, this is the fee. It's not like that. It's like a witch hunt to go through the website, believe me, and find this fee. You literally have to type in a search to even come up with it. When I found out about the fee, I was trying to see where it was on the website. So I typed in a search on the website. It took me forever to figure out where this fee was. Okay. And I finally found it. Yeah, it is in there somewhere. Okay. Believe me.
Thank you.
And that's, you know, and that's really all I can state.
Mr. Harris,
earlier in your comments, you mentioned that you were told that there could be a fee of a few hundred dollars.
Yeah, I asked about it. I saw something about there's a road fee, and somebody said, oh, well, the road fees are usually about $600 to $800.
Who is the somebody?
I think it was just even up at the counter when Jim and I were down there turning in the blueprints and submitting for the permit. We just kind of asked it. You know, I was asking just fees, and I was trying to determine what my costs were. And I had no idea that, and this wasn't even presented to me until 2 weeks or more, you know, into the process when I had plan check.
And then the other comment you made relative to borrowing money, did you borrow money for these fees or borrow money for the permit?
No, I borrowed money for these fees so I could get my permit last week.
So you have the fees that are paid for now.
It's paid.
You just owe the money back.
To the person I borrowed it from.
I see.
Because I needed, that was my catch-22. I couldn't get the funding released from the bank until I paid that fee. Public Works wouldn't release my permit until I paid the fee.
All right.
I called my wife and I said, can we borrow some money from somebody? She called her dad. And so we got a loan from him. Got the permit, got the funds released, money back.
Okay.
In order just to move.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Harris. So back to the board, and we're doing.
Well, I don't know how we would defer fees if they've been paid. I mean, that's,
well,
they've already been paid, and the problem now lies between, I guess, Mr. Harris and the people that he borrowed the money from to pay that back. This is kind of putting us in an odd position too, because if we'd have been made aware of this sooner, maybe we could have talked about ways to defer this until you had the home built, but we couldn't.
Yeah, that's how I was trying. That's what I was told would happen. If it was an appeal, it wouldn't be held.
So
okay, I'm. You know, I hate to do this, but I'm going to make a.
Can that money be refunded so that he can pay towards the end of his project? I don't know. I'm asking for.
I believe that it's possible. I don't know that it would be desirable. I guess that would be up to Mr. Harris. There is a procedure to go through on the deferral. You have to pay 20% up front. You have to sign an agreement, sign a lien on the property. He's got to get the bank or whoever is holding his financing to go along with it. This process has been in effect for a couple of years because of the economy.
Right.
To date, nobody has taken advantage of it for those reasons. It hasn't turned out to be desirable.
Sure.
And I
sure.
think
just a second, I think
I just Ms. wanted Arnold to know the I'm assuming that if the house was there in 1991 when this road fee project, when the road fees were implemented, that was at a date when permitting was required. So you would have a permitted home in the pipeline somewhere. You would have a record. Or was that pre-permit time?
There were certainly building permits required in 1991.
So I guess
when we're looking for records that are old, I can tell you we don't have a record of it.
Yeah. So when the road fees were implemented, there was no house and most likely nothing, no kind of impact fees had been paid at that time. Where I'm going with this is I understand the conundrum we're in, and that is that a $9 million, for example, project right in the neighborhood was built. Probably you calculate how many parcels are there that can be built on in the future, and those kind of impact fees are calculated into what you can or cannot do in the area, which you according. So you've calculated and spent money according to getting X amount of money from these particular lots as they're built. So we get that part, and I do sympathize with Mr. Harris, and I've had experience with that too, where as much as I know the county tries to make the public aware, it's a different language sometimes to lay people, one-time builders or builders, owner builders. So it is difficult, and I appreciate how much these fees are and how unaffordable housing becomes with the fees constantly going up. So anyway, I just wanted those questions answered. Thank you.
Just to wrap up, I think the another issue here, I would not want to see Mr. Harris have to go get money back on a deferral and then find a lien placed on his property by the bank. I don't think he wants to go that route. And I know that the rest of the community of Templeton they either should or they have known for some time there are some significant road fees. I hear about that all the time. Templeton's got the most expensive road fees in the county. And so the CSD, if they were to indicate that they didn't know, I'm a little disappointed to hear that because they should.
Should.
So with that, I made the motion.
All right. And
pretty good.
Seeing no further discussion, I will ask for a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Sorry.
Thank you. So, and with that, Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our final item, please.
Item number 31, hearings to consider 5 proposals to establish a new agricultural preserve and amend existing agricultural preserves, districts 1 and 5.
Ms. Griffin.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gibson and members of the board. Cami Griffin, County Planning and Building. This is our first group of agricultural preserve applications coming before your board this year. And there are 5 applications, 4 of which are amendments to reflect lot line adjustments, and then a new preserve. We expect a second group of ag preserves coming in the fall, just to give you a heads up. And with that, I'll turn it over to Terry Waller, who hopefully had enough time to get set up in my introduction, who will discuss each item.
Mr. Waller, Master of Agricultural Preserves.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Terry Waller, planning staff. I just wanted to point out that these are mostly amendments to agricultural preserves, setting the stage a little bit. There is just that one additional one, but this is something we're seeing more and more of, adjustments and amendments to the existing ones. We have quite a few of them out there, as you know. This first application is a proposal by Patricia Diane Vineyard, LLC. This is to alter the boundaries of an agricultural preserve to reflect a lot line adjustment. The resulting parcel will include approximately 54 acres, and the property is located in the agriculture land use category, approximately a half a mile west of Buena Vista Drive, and approximately 2,000 feet east of River Road, north of and abutting the city of Paso Robles. The parcel is in the Salinas River planning area. This request is, again, a irrigated vineyard on Class 2 and 4 soils. The appropriate minimum parcel size for the amended agricultural preserve is 40 acres, again, based on the irrigated vineyard. And the appropriate term is 10 years because the rules of procedure allow that the site located within 1 mile of an urban reserve line, in this case Paso Robles, qualifies for a 10-year as opposed to a 20-year term. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission recommend approval of this request to amend an agricultural preserve to the board. That would conclude my comment for
Thank
that one.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. Questions from the board? Mr. Beecham.
Terry, what are you said that most of these are lot line adjustments, or what's the do they give a reasoning behind what they're doing?
There's usually a variety of reasons. A lot of times, in this case, they're trying to acquire additional property. So they actually wanted to buy some additional land from the neighbor, and since both were in contract, they just have that one extra procedure they have to go through, which is to amend their land conservation contract and ag preserve.
And the existing neighbor that owns the property, that's in ag, obviously.
Both of them, yeah.
Both of them are in ag. And are, well, you said they're not in irrigation.
The area that they're buying is actually not cultivated, and it also involves a home site. So they're actually acquiring a home, some additional agricultural land from the neighbor. And both are vineyard properties. It's just that area that they're acquiring, the 14 acres, doesn't happen to be in vineyard at this time, but it could be in future. So again, this is an acquisition of additional property type of lot line adjustment, of which, again, there are many different varieties.
And I guess I'm just still a little bit unclear as to the why would we want to put this in an ag?
Well, it's already in an ag preserve. The whole property is.
That other property is too. Then.
Yeah, in fact, it might be helpful. Sometimes, you know what they say, a picture's worth a thousand words. Maybe we should just look at the graphic. I think I could explain it to you.
I understand now a little bit better. I thought I was thinking.
There's a little note that says property to be added, and that's the area that's not cultivated. But you know, it's just making the smaller parcel bigger and the bigger parcel a little bit smaller. Both comply, and both will comply after lot line adjustment's done.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right, we'll open it to the public. No requests to speak and no one coming forward. We'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Move staff's recommendation.
I have a second.
Second.
Thank you. And a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes. Next up.
This is the other half of the lot line adjustment. It's a proposal by Woodland Trust to alter the boundaries of an agricultural reserve, again, to reflect the lot line adjustment. The resulting parcel in this case will include approximately 114 acres, and it's located in the ag land use category, again, Buena Vista Drive, abutting the city of Paso Robles, and the Salinas River planning area. And the Woodland Trust property is requesting lot line adjustment for the other reason, to transfer approximately 14 acres to the neighbor. The adjustment would decrease the acreage from this parcel from the current 120 acres to approximately 114. This property has 92 acres of irrigated vineyard, a little bit more acreage in vineyard. The resulting parcel will continue to meet eligibility requirements for both the primeland agricultural preserve and a land conservation contract with the 92 acres of irrigated vineyard on Class 2 and 4 soils. You'll be seeing the land conservation contract part of it, which comes as a consent item later in the year with all of these, actually. The appropriate minimum parcel size, again, based on the irrigated vineyard, is 40 acres. The appropriate term, 10 years, because of its proximity to Paso Robles Urban Reserve Line, actually abutting Paso Robles. And the same recommendation on this one from the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission, recommendation for approval on the amendment to the boundaries of this agricultural preserve. Includes my comments.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, open it to the public. Seeing none, bring it back to the board.
Move staff's recommendation.
Second.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, roll call.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Mr. Waller.
And this is the next item is an application for a brand new agricultural preserve and doesn't involve a lot line adjustment. It's a proposal by Flight Investments, LLC, to establish an ag preserve to enable the applicant to later enter into a land conservation contract. The 50-acre parcel is located within the agriculture land use category at 495 Cripple Creek Road, approximately 3/4 mile south of the intersection of Creston Road and Cripple Creek Road. And this is about 5 miles southeast of the urban reserve line of Paso Robles in the El Pomar Estrella planning area. The property consists of generally flat land planted extensively in irrigated vineyards. The property also includes a residence, some scattered oaks, and a small fallow areas. The vineyards were planted beginning in the year 2000. Through next item, item D on the staff report, is actually a reconsideration of a proposal by Claudine Blackwell to alter the boundaries of an agricultural preserve to reflect a lot line adjustment. This resulting parcel will remain at approximately 120 acres. The project site is located in the agriculture land use category at 1030 Penman Springs Road, approximately half a mile southeast of the intersection of Penman Springs Road and Union Road, and approximately 1.1 mile east of the city of Paso Robles. This is, again, the El Pomar Estrella planning area. And this request from the applicant is to amend the ag preserve boundaries. It's driven by a lot line adjustment again. In this case, the lot line adjustment involves a very minor exchange of land between the two landowners. And this has to do with a remedy for three different fence line encroachments, which is kind of a shame, you know, that they had to go all this trouble to make that, to do this adjustment. But that's the situation that we find ourselves in. This application actually was heard by your board in November of 2010. It was approved, the ag preserve part of it, and then we proceeded with the land conservation contract, which kind of locks everything in, and that becomes an important part of this whole process. When the applicants were reviewing their land conservation contracts, they started thinking more about the term, and in some cases, staff recommends a 20-year term if they're repackaging properties and want to be in the Williamson Act anyway. A lot of times there isn't a concern about the 20-year term. In this case, there was, and the applicant felt that because of some ongoing estate issues and wanting to maintain flexibility, they came back and requested a reconsideration and requested a 10-year term. This property entered into the program as a dry farm property with a portion still under this agricultural use, and the other areas of property have since been planted in an irrigated vineyard. The property continues to qualify as for an agricultural preserve based on this mixed agricultural use. Irrigated vineyard, in this case, is approximately 60 acres, so they're committed to agriculture. The appropriate minimum parcel size for agricultural preserves in mixed use is between 80 and 160. In this case, we're recommending the 160. Again, back to the term. The 10-year term is actually appropriate because the existing land conservation contract that's in place right now already is maintaining a 10-year term, and the minimum term requirement for the Williamson Act under the government code is 10 years, so they satisfy that. We reviewed this with County Council, and they confirmed our interpretation. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission also considered this reconsideration request involving the term and is recommending approval of this request to amend an agricultural preserve to your board.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. Questions of Mr. Waller? Seeing none, open to the public. Seeing no one, coming back to the board. Ms. Arnold.
I move to recommend adopt staff's recommendations.
All right. Second. Thank you. And was that a second from Mr. Meacham? Sounded like it. With that, a roll call, please.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And our last one.
And the final item is the Harnish Trust, which is the other part of this lot line adjustment. And it is a reconsideration also of a proposal by Keith Harnish to alter the boundaries of an agricultural preserve to reflect this same lot line adjustment. In this case, the resulting parcel size for this property will be approximately 440 acres. And the property is located in the agricultural land use category at 1975 Hidden Acre Lane. This is approximately a mile southeast of the intersection of Penman Springs Road and Union Road, and approximately 1.5 miles east of the city of Paso Robles. Again, El Pomar Estrella planning area. And this application is, of course, the other part of the one that we previously mentioned just before this. And so it involves the same set of circumstances that was previously heard by your board, November of 2010. It was approved. And the applicants, at the time of the contracts, decided they wanted to request a 10-year term. This property is solely a dry farm property. It continues to qualify for the agricultural preserve as a dry farm property. And again, the term that would be appropriate here is 10 years, and it's based on the same information. The Williamson Act only requires a 10-year term, and it currently has a 10-year term on this contract, and the applicants are requesting that flexibility. The Agricultural Preserve Review Committee and the Planning Commission also recommended approval of this request to amend an agricultural preserve.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions? Seeing none, open it to the public. Seeing no one, bring it back to the board.
Move to adopt staff recommendations.